Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message.
Today, I'm so excited. I don't have any announcements for you besides that, but I'm so excited because you get to hear from my dear friend, Sarah Hansen. I'm going to invite her to come up. Sarah and her husband, Darren, have been a part of this community for a long time. Their two kids are up there, hopefully with my kids, not destroying things. We'll see afterwards. I'm so glad Darren was a campus pastor out at our Issaquah campus, and they've just been really solid, foundational people for our crew, and I'm so excited for you to hear from her. She's a dear friend of mine, someone who asks great questions and has a comedic response usually when we're trying to process what we think as friends. So please do a great job of welcoming my friend Sarah Hansen.
Thank you. Oh, please. I have breathe and slow down written on every page of my notes, and I will probably do neither over the next bit. Well, hello. It's nice to see everyone. I just want to give a shout out. I have an entire row of family on this side. I have a husband in the back, and welcome to everyone here. Mary Brandenburg is in the front row. One of my favorites. I'm going to embarrass her and Craig for a moment just to say that Craig has brought Mary breakfast in bed every morning of their marriage.
Not our entire marriage.
How long?
Since about 2000.
Since 2000. So Darren, you back there? You hear that? Breakfast in bed? Healthy and thriving? I also want to give a big shout out to my mother-in-law, Kathy Hansen, who watches faithfully online. Hello, Kathy. I know she's watching. She told me that she's going to be crying the entire time I'm talking, so she was glad she wasn't going to be here, which I wish she was here, but thank you for watching. I was looking back randomly over my notes on my phone, and maybe you take notes on your phone. I have lots and lots of notes and lots of lists, mostly. But I found a note from a message I believe Ryan gave on February 28th, 2016, and I wrote down a quote, and it says, "You can't grow from where you are unless you can be honest about where you are." And that's what I'm going to attempt to do today and this morning, but I don't know if it's going to be helpful, but that's all we have. So, like, we're going to have to just do that, okay? It's a funny thing to be sitting up here from this point of view, because I've been attending Eastlake for about 10 years, and I've pretty much been offended and skeptical the entire time, and that includes today, okay? I brought my Bible for probably at least the first 2 or 3 years. And when a verse was shared, I would immediately be looking it up and making sure that they didn't get it wrong. And then I would scoff and feel very proud if I felt like it was taken out of context. And I'm sure it was like I was a blast to be around in those days, okay? I did feel very accepted, though. And a lot of that was because I was dating Darren Hansen. And he's much loved, and a lot of people know him. So I felt like, well, at least I kind of fit in because I'm with him. As the years went on, I had a growing sense that things were changing both for me and the church. I would show up to church ready to defend my long-held beliefs and really afraid of what I was going to hear. What would it be this week that made me really defensive and angry? Often these anxieties would come out against my husband, Darren. We've had many arguments in our marriage, but probably the most passionate have been about Eastlake. And when I mean Eastlake, I mean that we would hear a message, we'd get in the car, and I would be fuming mad about something that was said in the message, and I would give my own short sermon, about why it was absolutely wrong and unbiblical, and I would look over at Darren, and he would be very calm and, like, not bothered, And I would look at him and say, why aren't you panicking? That's how I felt a lot. So we often hear people talk up here about the pain of grief, of growing and learning and changing and evolving. But if you're experiencing it right now, I just have to tell you, I'm very empathetic to that. I have never felt the panic I have felt when I've heard a message that have challenged some of my long-held beliefs. So you may be wondering, why are you here? A really good question. Some days I have an answer of why I'm still here, and some days I hope no one will ask me. I was recently, though, asked why I still go to Eastlake, and this is how I answered. For 24 years, I went to pretty traditional Christian churches. I am very well-versed in Bible studies, some that I went to and some that I would do in my bedroom with my own highlighter, okay? I grew up singing hymns, listening to worship music and other Christian contemporary bands. Shout out Jars of Clay. I attended high school youth groups, summer camps, Awanas, went on mission trips. And all of this gave me such a sense of safety and security that deeply impacted my sense of identity and view of Christianity. And I would say even more so, my faith in Jesus was what specifically meant the most to me. I was really ready to leave Eastlake many times due to the constant struggle of needing to be right and feeling like the direction of Eastlake challenged my sense of what was right. And then 2015 came. During the months that followed Eastlake's inclusion announcement, I knew I was going to cry.
I experienced for the first time what it feels like to be told that you're on the wrong side. And that God will judge you for all of eternity for where you go to church. And I'll pray for you to come back to the right side. And I just couldn't believe it. To all of a sudden be on the wrong side was so enlightening. And all I could really think about was all the times I made sure people knew that they were on the wrong side. So it's been really hard to get what I want to say onto paper and to be able to find the words. And I think the reason is when people ask me, well, you know, what do you believe about this or that? I just tend to go blank. And then I begin talking, which ends up being a rambling tale of what I did believe, what I don't believe anymore, and what I'm thinking about currently, intermixed with some random defensiveness about the Bible, Jesus, and my family, which I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that my family has chosen, and especially my parents, to continue in relationship with me through this experience of being at Eastlake, because I know people, not everybody can say that. So we've been going through the teachings in Matthew here at Eastlake. And I've gone all over the place while planning on what to share this morning. As I was reading through Matthew, this verse stuck out to me, and I thought I would dig in a bit. Jesus is speaking to a group of people, and he says, Matthew 7:7-8, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Though on the first read, it may seem like Jesus is saying, hey, whatever you ask, I'm going to give it to you. And that's actually what it says. However, in the Greek, the words ask, seek, and knock are all written with a sense of continuous action. So it's more accurate to read it, keep asking and it will be given to you. Keep seeking and you will find. Keep knocking and the door will be open to you. I've mostly heard this verse interpreted through the lens of prayer. As in, if you continue to pray for blank, then it will be given to you. And the problem is, that's just not always true. So then I've heard people say, well, it's not that you get whatever you want. God knows best and gives you what you need. And it's not always in the way you would expect, and plus you may not have full awareness until you're in heaven. And that's kind of where the conversation would end.
So for this morning, I thought we would use some sanctified imagination to look beyond how this verse has been originally explained to me. And I'm going to tell you about what I've been asking and what I've been seeking and some stuff about knocking. So first, what am I asking? Again, when I think of this verse and the thought of asking, we think of someone who's asking for something like, I'd like a car or a raise or a pocket watch. I think pocket watches are really cool. Like with the vest and the pocket and the... Okay. I think this limits this idea of asking. It makes it materialistic and perhaps not what Jesus was referring to. I don't think it makes much sense that he was talking about physical or tangible items, and maybe he was. But for a moment, consider, rather than asking for something, what if you considered, what am I asking? And to ask is to admit that we need help, and that we don't have it all, and we don't know it all, which is my hardest one. Over the past several months and years, there's been lots of questions I've been grappling with, and I'm going to give you a few examples. Number one, how can I both be seeking to deepen my awareness of the world, matters of the spirit, differences and similarities with other people, be more open, accepting, inclusive, and yet still be grounded in Jesus? Secondly, how have white heterosexual men shaped my view of God, the Bible, Jesus, the church, my own body, my role, my identity? I quickly follow up that question with asking, how then have I perpetuated those messages to women that have caused them pain? One of the big questions I've been wrestling with lately is, how do I talk and share about my faith with my children, Hope and Dylan? This is a big one for me, because it's one thing for me to be deconstructing and reconstructing, but I get so nervous about how that could be impacting them and their own journey of faith. One of the largest struggles I have is with this idea of certainty. I just yearn, if you can't tell already, you will shortly, that I yearn for safety and security. Uncertainty for me has always provided that. Certainty in knowing that I'm right and that I have the truth. The problem is, if I'm being honest, those beliefs I used to be so certain in, I've come to realize are different for different people, and even within the under the umbrella of Christianity. And because I value safety and security, I really want to offer that to my children. However, the community they are being raised in is different than the one I was raised in, and they're being taught different messages, and this creates anxiety in me, as I noted before. Cindy Wing Brandt has been someone I'm leaning into and looking to for leadership in this area. She's an author, and she has a blog as well. Her book, Parenting Forward, How to Raise Children with Justice, Mercy, and Kindness, is coming out the end of February. I recently heard her speak at a conference and wanted to hear hours more. She wrote this on her blog last April. The title was, For the Deconstructing Parent. Those of us who have walked away from authoritarian, hierarchical, orthodoxy-centered systems are often wary of indoctrinating our own children. We become afraid of giving our children another set of propositions that are going to harm them the way we have been harmed. So we angst over how to respond when they ask hard questions, pull evasive maneuvers in conversation, or we simply stay silent for fear of saying the wrong things. We feel like rubble, so we think we have nothing to offer. Or at least we feel like we have to go through the process of deconstructing and be all sorted out before we can parent our children. She goes on to say that by telling our own story to our children is the way forward. This means you may have to tell ugly stories about yourself, how you regret some of what you used to do in the name of God, how you changed your mind and lost friendships, or how you are in sharp disagreement with your children's beloved grandparents. It may mean you give them the messy truth instead of tidy propositions. But listen, they are children. They understand messes, especially mine. They don't want perfect parents. They want loving parents. And most of all, they want you to be real and need you to be true. So I'm so grateful to have resources and leaders who've been asking similar or same questions and are gifted in writing and podcasting so I can hear and process what they have to say. I may not even relate to all of it or feel the exact same way, but it's helpful in gaining ideas and resources. So I'm going to be asking these questions along with many others and trusting that I'm going to receive direction as I walk forward. It may not always look like answers, but it might be resources or conversations or people that come into my life that I get to receive from. So what am I seeking? Right now, I'm seeking out women to help me grow in my understanding of who Jesus is, specifically women of color, black women, through a womanist theology. What does Jesus look and sound like from their perspective? I fully recognize these viewpoints, theologies, and cultures are not new. And just because I'm currently coming upon them for the first time says more about my lack of awareness than their validity. These voices have been there all along, and I regret it's taken this long for me to seek them out. As I've been seeking these women out, I've had some startling realizations along the way. These realizations, shocker, just create more questions and lead to more seeking, and typically make me go unpack and deconstruct something I've been holding on to. One of those realizations have been about the concept of freedom. Civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer in the 1960s articulates black women's understanding of Jesus in relation to freedom. She takes us a bit further than the equality language by challenging our understanding of and desire for mere equality. And she says this, "I couldn't tell nobody with my head up I'm fighting for equal rights with a white man because I don't want it. Because if what I get got to come through lynching, mobbing, raping, murdering, stealing, and killing, I didn't want it." We are challenged to move beyond mere equality to freedom. Freedom is the central message of Jesus Christ and the gospel.
Well, hey everyone, excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own community. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
I think for me, I have not recognized to the fullest extent what freedom really means and looks like for people who don't experience it or don't have it currently. I've never thought about freedom being the central message of the gospel. Not that it wasn't a part of it, not that I hadn't heard that concept. But for me, the goal was focusing on getting the details right and believing the right thing and then doing the right thing. I'm actually grieved with how much time has been consumed with my own obsession of my own personal salvation and the rightness of my theology when other people are seeking Jesus as an actual liberator and source of freedom. It's a whole different conversation and focus. When you're living under power and fighting for your actual freedom, the conversation about freedom becomes much more personal and relevant. Author and racial justice advocate Austin Channing Brown writes in her book, I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness, about her first time in a black church in Toledo. And she says this, "That day I fell in love. I fell in love with the soaring voices and the songs which moved us to tears and then chased the blues away. I fell in love with Jesus who saw the poor and sick and hurting, a Jesus who had bigger plans for me than keeping me a virgin, a Jesus who loved and reveled in our blackness." And the first time I read that quote, I was sitting on my couch, and I had to like read it 3 or 4 times, and I had to stop and think about it. Because did she just say that Jesus had bigger plans than keeping me a virgin? I had to put it down and do some thinking. And here's the thing, some of you have no idea what I'm talking about, okay? And you're way ahead of me on this, okay? And maybe you never thought Jesus cared so much about your virginity. However, because of growing up in the True Love Waits and I Kissed Dating Goodbye culture of the 90s, my lens for Jesus was that he cared the most about my virginity because that's what made me whole. This could be a talk all on its own, okay? But I've operated for a long time under this idea that purity, and let me be clear, purity in all areas, because it doesn't just stop at virginity. It goes to not doing drugs, not getting drunk, not swearing, not watching R-rated movies, and so on and so forth. And so my standard for myself was like the virginity engulfed all of that, and that my standard, purity and perfection was my standard and my theology. And that theology, when you have that theology, it led me to a stance of pride and judgment toward those who made different choices, and especially towards women. From that one very brief sentence in Austin's book, I have now been trying to figure out what was this bigger plan that this black church in Toledo was focused on that didn't create or identify virginity or purity as being the number one goal in her life or the other women there? And how did that impact their view of Jesus during that time? As I'm seeking, I have found some really hard truths, and have made me realize my own participation with perpetuating oppression. And then I've had to grieve and take responsibility for my own actions and ideas. I think for me, I can get on the bandwagon of I'm really mad at what I was taught and hold my parents and books and pastors and churches all responsible, and yet I don't think it's that simple. And the biggest example, or I guess proof I have this, is this picture. Okay. All right? Now, let me explain what's happening, okay? We had just moved to Logan, Utah, and this was our first night of Awanas. And this is my older sister, Rachel. Look at her, so sweet. Got that sweet little, you know, just calm, just a calm demeanor, best friend necklace, headed to go see her best friend. Look at Danny, just cute, you know, she's got no patches yet, Danny, no patches. It's her first night, okay, like back off. But she's so excited, and then look at that girl, look at Sarah, pointing to my Bible with a lot of seriousness, okay? Look at those pants. And the belt, okay. It's not about the clothes, okay. So I've asked both of my sisters this week to confirm, and they did, that neither have lost more than 5 minutes of sleep due to fears, anxieties, worries about matters of faith. I'm not saying they haven't given it thought. Both of them, incredibly wise, smart, and have done a lot of thinking. But there's a big difference in the level of fear and anxiety that I've held within me about matters of faith. So last night, I asked Darren to do some math. If on average I have spent 3 hours a week while trying to fall asleep worrying about my faith, then I have probably lost over 4,000, I'm gonna start crying again, 4,176. Hours of sleep, which translates to 174 days, which translates to almost 6 months, over the last 29 years, laying in my bed, worrying, crying, thinking and panicking about spiritual things. So I've been curious and seeking to look at the past honestly and ask if it was more about my own wiring and the way my mind put together what I was hearing and reading that really had an impact. I don't really remember, honestly, there being a time in my life where I haven't worried, just a little bit. Fear, I've always said, has been a constant companion and at times not very friendly. So while my little brain was developing, And while this propensity for anxiety, right, is just growing in my mind, that is probably in some ways genetically wired in me, at that same time, I'm learning about hell. And I'm learning about how some people are going to be going there and some people aren't. And you might be familiar with the research of brain, the brain research that's shown that, you know, neurons that fire together wire together, right? So these are all coming together at the same time. And so my hypothesis is that while my brain wired together my feelings of experiences of anxiety that was separate just in my own body, and then wiring together with my Christian beliefs, that they've been crossed. And I can't, I have a hard time existing in life without them always being together. So when I'm experiencing anxiety about something completely random, I often think about spiritual matters. Like, that's what comes into my mind first. And when I'm sitting in church and hearing ideas about faith, my anxiety raises. So I'm not here, please, clearly here, I'm not saying that damage hasn't been done by church and people and books and all of that. And I know many of you here today have been deeply hurt. So do not hear me saying that it was, you know, oh, it's all your fault and just in your head. If anything, what I'm saying is that I am the person in the churches that was hurting people because I was so filled with anxiety and fear. I felt it was my duty to save you and everyone else. And we know that fear cannot develop and nurture love. And so I'm having to relearn some basic things about God, and it feels weird, and it feels like a whole rewiring of a big part of my brain. But I think that by blaming others for my experience with all of this only stunts my own continuation of seeking to grow and mature. Okay, let's just take a little breather. While I was looking for that other picture, I found this one. I had my hair like this long just a little bit before that, and I announced to my parents that I wanted to cut my hair like my dad's. And being wise, they said no. And they said, you have to wait 3 months, and if you still want it in 3 months, you can. Well, I'm stubborn and strong-willed, so at 3 months, it didn't matter anymore. I was going to get my hair cut like my dad. So he took me to his barber. I think the barber was crying almost, having to cut my hair, and there we go. Boom. Had my hair cut like my dad's. Okay, that was random. Let's go back to the serious matters. So where am I knocking? What am I knocking on, and whose door is it anyway? So for me, I'm going back and knocking on some of the doors I used to hang out at a lot. I was listening to an interview with author Sue Monk Kidd and Oprah, and they were talking about how it's important to be a seeker, but acknowledge when we've actually found something. She says, it's time to start finding things. There's a hunger in you. It's appropriate to follow that. But we should also be finders at the same time. It's one of those paradoxes I'm getting more comfortable to live with, that we can be a seeker and a finder at the same time. At the beginning of each year, my sister and I do goals, okay? I mean, resolutions, but not like goals, okay? And we come up with our personal theme for each year. I looked at some of the past themes that I wrote down, and like in 2013, calm. Like, you're gonna see a theme, okay? Calm. I had just started graduate school. In 2016, it was simplify. I had a newborn and a two-year-old. In 2017, clear and quiet, okay? In 2015, randomly, Optimus Prime. I have no idea. I don't know. Optimus Prime was my goal. I don't know. This year, my theme is savor and reclaim. Savoring is about being present and loving the sweet moments I'm having with my kids before they start school. The reclaim part is moving forward and allowing myself to reclaim parts of my faith that I feel like I've had to not engage in or not look to for the past few years. For example, I think I want to knock and have the door open to reclaiming music as a way to connect with God. I used to listen to a lot of Christian music, you know, Spirit 105. I haven't really been able to do it for a long time. And I know it means I can't just go back to probably listening to Spirit 105.3. I mean, I could. So for me, it's learning to search out new artists that are in similar places or grappling with the same questions and are gifted in writing and singing. And maybe that means they're not even Christian singers, right? Like just that they have those questions and grapplings that I have. So I'm knocking with a purpose to actually find something, whether it be something new or part of my reclaiming, but I would like to begin to gather some of what I've found or am finding and be able to speak to those things. So when I look at these three action verbs, asking, seeking, knocking, I find that each requires a deeper level of vulnerability. We can ask from a distance. You can ask a question and never even say it out loud. You can ask and even receive an answer, yet stay still of where you are. To seek takes a bit more effort. You have to move, you have to look closer, you might have to uncover something or unearth it to see what's been hidden from view. And that can be a bit risky. Knocking is the most vulnerable of the three because you first have to identify where to knock. And then once you've knocked, you wait. And this verse makes it clear that you're being asked to knock again, and to choose to do that takes courage. And to choose to knock continuously feels like almost an act of rebellion. It's saying, I will stand here and knock until this door opens. And when it does open, it tends to lead to more questions, which tends to lead to more seeking, which leads me to another door. So looking back at the way I've always interpreted this verse was so much about asking and seeking and hoping to have the door open to the right and clear answers to all of life. One door, one open. And now I'm starting to see that because it's this idea of continual asking, seeking, and knocking, that perhaps this idea of arriving is part of the problem. By Jesus using this language of continual asking, seeking, and knocking, it seems to imply that we are in perpetual cycle of growing and evolving, learning what to leave behind, and taking along things we find on this journey. So what are you asking? Do you know? Do you know what you're seeking or where you're looking? Have you stopped somewhere and has stopped knocking? I think it's a really important idea as well that the verse is everybody. I don't know if you remember. It says to everybody. Where'd my verse go? One moment, I'm gonna find it. For everyone who asks receives. And everyone who knocks, the door will be open. That's a key thing. It doesn't say, it goes back to that idea of freedom, that it's not just about who's in and who's out with the equality of like, oh, let's just be equal. It's this freedom that everybody gets to knock and everybody gets to seek and everybody then will receive. So my prayer is that we continue to ask and receive and that we seek and find and that we continue to knock with courage. Will you stand with me? Oops, my tissues. Didn't need as much as I thought. So as you're able, let's stand. We now extinguish our communal flame, sending the light and warmth into our hearts, that we may go in peace to love and to serve, because life is a gift and love is a point. Thank you so much.